This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, we'll get started. I would, of course, like to acknowledge the traditional owners of Canberra and on the lands of which the museum sits. We have, a really exciting hour and a half ahead of us. The Silk Road exhibition for the museum has been an extraordinary success, and actually an unpredicted success. We're, of course, proud of any exhibition we put on, and we believe that any exhibition has a relevance to the Australian community. But the Silk Road was quite a surprise to us. We were expecting good visitation, and we were getting astounding visitation. Anyone who came to the night markets last Friday... you know, which sent us all into conniptions, whatever. It was just astounding that the interest in the stories of the Silk Road. Again, we, as the National Museum of Australia, of course, we usually tell Australian histories, so we had that difficulty of saying, how does this become relevant? How do we make this story relevant to Australia? So we, of course, promoted that Australia's own intellectual legacy relies a lot on what was happening during the heyday of the Silk Road. It's the sciences, the philosophies, religion, all these things that have created the societies across Europe and the Middle East and Asia have influenced us in the long term. And that was the message we were getting out to people. But it turns out we didn't have to try so hard. People, the audiences, seem to have been extremely hungry for this sort of information. And so it's been a challenge to me because... as a curator here at the museum, I would have told the story differently. But quite clearly, this way of telling the story, the exhibition, has worked. So I've been forced to look at my own practices and my own ways of looking at how exhibitions should be done. And that's always a pleasant surprise when you can get a chance to just correct yourself. So, moving on. Our first speaker will be Dr. Ken Parry. From Macquarie University. Dr. Parry is a senior lecturer and research fellow in the Department of Ancient History and a member of the Ancient Cultures Research Centre. His studies include philosophy, theology, comparative religion, ancient medieval philosophy, church history and patristics. A doctorate in Byzantine theology. And there's a stack more here. I don't know if I could go through the whole lot. It's incredible. So you've done massive amounts. I'll just, to save time. And followed by Joyce Morgan, and I'll talk more about Joyce when her turn comes. So at that stage, I'll now go and sit down and enjoy the papers as much as you do. So welcome, Ken, to the stage.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, Michael, for that introduction. I've got 20 minutes to talk about the history of Silk Road. It's not possible. So I've confined it very much to the Chinese side of things, so we're going to visit a few places in China associated with the ancient Silk Road. My particular interest is in the ancient religious cultures of the Silk Road, and that's what I'm going to be talking about mostly this afternoon. So let's just remind ourselves about the Silk Road and where it went. If we start in Europe and we come through Asia or the Middle East in through Persia into the Central Asian part, you can see in the middle of an ancient place called Bactria. This was the ancient Western Greek name for Central Asia, that is the area of Uzbekistan today. And you can see that it comes through into what is Chinese Central Asia, Xinjiang, and right down to Chang'an, right towards the right of the map, which is Xi'an, the ancient capital, particularly during the Tang Dynasty. Chang'an is another name given to it. But I want you to note also that it goes further, that it goes through to Japan. It's often forgotten that Japan was part of the ancient Silk Road as well. So this is the overlands road that you can see, but we also have to remember that there's a maritime Silk Road which comes down through the Arabia to South India and on to Sumatra and up to the South China Sea. So we'll always have to bear in mind that we've got an overland and a maritime route for the Silk Road. The name Silk Road, of course, is a very modern invention. Not till the 19th century is it used in Western sources. But I want to take you to Nara in Japan first, because there's a connection between Canberra and Nara. I'm sure most of you know that it's a twin city, Canberra and Nara. And in Nara is a famous collection of Silk Road objects. Perhaps the most famous in many ways, but not so famous because it's not known so well. But at Nara in the 8th century, the Japanese emperor inaugurated a giant Buddha in the hall here that you can see on the left, which is still one of the largest wooden buildings in the world. And as a result of this inauguration of a giant Buddha at Nara, emperor in China sent many gifts to the Japanese emperor. And these gifts were put into a special collection and have survived right through. It's called the Shoso Inn in Nara. And there are not many of these objects still kept in this particular building. They're in the museum in Tokyo, in Kyoto, and in Nara. But this collection of objects is all from the 8th century or pre-8th century, and it is a unique collection of objects. So if any of you know anybody connected with the Japanese embassy in Canberra, you might suggest that we do an exhibition, because I've never seen an exhibition of some of these items from the Shoso in Australia. Silk fabrics, you can see some here from the Shoso Inn collection. You can see on the left, these are very much in the Sasanian Persian tradition, with some decorations showing the mounted horsemen on these left in these roundels, and some nice other silk fabric on the other side showing some trees and birds. These motifs are known from the Sasanian Persian tradition. Musical instruments, which came through from, again, from Persia through Central Asia to the Chinese court, the Tang Dynasty in Xi'an in this period from the 7th through to the 9th century. This was a great time of openness in Chinese history. And these musical instruments you can see beautifully preserved with inlay of mother of pearl. These are part of the collection in Nara. Also glass and metal. Glass has come all the way from Syria. Syria was an important center for glass making in the Roman period and in the early Christian period. The Chinese hadn't really developed the art of making glass in the way that it had developed in the West. So they were very interested and keen to get pieces of glass which came along the ancient Silk Road into China. And on the right, you can see an example of a Sasanian Persian metalwork in the period of the Sasanians up until the 7th century of the Common Era. Metalwork was highly developed in the Sasanian Persian world. Dance masks. These are very interesting. I'm sure you'll recognize the character on the left. He looks very much like Mr. Punch, doesn't he? Well, there was a tradition of dance dramas that came through probably from India into Central Asia. It was often used by Buddhist missionaries to enact tales of the Buddha and the life of the Buddha and so on. And these became very popular in Central Asia and again in China. And there's a whole quite extensive collection of these dance masks in the Nara Shoso Inn collection as well. So we have the drunken Persian king on the left, and that's Mrs. Wu on the right. And there's a whole drama that goes with this, and it still goes on in various other communities in Asia today. This is the colossal Buddha that was inaugurated in the early 8th century at Nara. It is still one of the largest metal Buddhas to survive from this period, as I say, in the 8th century. And it was to do with the inauguration of this particular colossal Buddha that these items were sent from China by the Chinese emperor to Nara.
and form part of this collection that subsequently you can still see in Japan today. Now, the tradition of colossal images of the Buddha, of course, everybody's aware of the Bamiyan Buddhas and the disaster associated with this, with the Taliban in 2001. But I think most people don't realize that there is a whole sequence of giant images of the Buddha, colossal images of the Buddha, that comes through. It began originally in northern India, through into Afghanistan and into Central Asia, Chinese Central Asia, and as you can see, right through to Nara in Japan. So there's a whole sequencing of these colossal images of the Buddha. But as I say, unfortunately, we can't see the giant images in Bamiyan today any longer. Perhaps it's worth pointing out, and up until 2001, none of these giant images of the Buddha at Bamiyan showed any signs of deliberate destruction before 2001. Most of the state that you can see in the left photograph has been due to natural erosion. For example, the Mongols, when they came through this period in the 13th century, they didn't destroy these giant Buddhas. So it's right up until 2001 that they remained. If we come into China, just to give you a couple of examples, a few examples of these continuing tradition of building large Buddha images, Majishan here in Gansu province, you can see them on the side of the mountain. These are a Buddhist cave complex here with some giant images of the Buddha going back to about the 6th and 7th century. Again, here's another example from Gansu. You can see a seated Buddha carved out of the cliff face here. The changes that you can see at the bottom on the left photograph are due to the changes in the local river and reservoir that has been set up. This would have been much more difficult to the land that you can see with the shepherd and his sheep would have been much lower down in the ancient period. This would have been much higher up and more difficult to get at. At Leshan, you can see this huge image of the Buddha here. Most of these Buddhas are dating back to this period of the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries in the early Tang Dynasty. You can get some idea of the scale of that from this photograph with people standing at the bottom of it. So bear in mind that the Bamiyan Buddhas are only one of a sequence of these colossal images of the Buddha. And they were very important for demonstrating and showing the teaching of the Buddha and how important the Buddha was in Central Asia, because it was through Central Asia, of course, that Buddhism came from northern India and eventually into China and into Japan. At Luoyang, there are some more examples, again dating to this similar period of the giant images of the Buddha, just to show you another example. Transportation, of course, on the ancient Silk Road was mostly by camel, but you can see the difference between the ancient and modern if you travel the Silk Road, particularly in Chinese Central Asia in Xinjiang today. Tang Dynasty, in the exhibition here at the museum, you can see some examples of some very fine Tang Dynasty figurines. The one on the right is interesting. It has a group of musicians, and many of these musicians often appear as Westerners who are traveling through Central Asia, and here you can see a group of them seated on the back of this Bactrian camel. A few more examples, again, all from the Tang Dynasty. This is from the early 7th through to the late 9th century. Tang Dynasty was, as I say, a period of great openness in Chinese history. And there was a need within China to possess a lot of Western objects. If we go to Xi'an, for example, which was the capital during the Tang Dynasty, this was the great city at the eastern end of the Silk Road. Nobody perhaps did the whole journey all the way from Xi'an to Constantinople or Rome. It was divided up into different sections with different geographical and ethnic groups being part of it. Here you can see a reenactment of a Tang ceremony in Xi'an if you visit there today. Xi'an, of course, is well known for its terracotta army going back into the Han Dynasty, And I'm sure that there are people in the audience who have visited this. It is a spectacular thing to see. And I understand very recently that the Chinese archaeologists have opened up a new section of this. When you go as Westerners to visit this, you only see one or possibly two sections. There are actually four sections, and at least two of them have not even been investigated by archaeologists yet. In Xi'an too is on the right. You can see the Wild Goose Pagoda, which is associated with the establishment, particularly of Buddhism, in the Tang Dynasty. Pagodas were based upon the stupa, which is an Indian tradition, and they were used for housing sutras and for keeping all sorts of liturgical objects to do with Buddhist ritual. But even by the 8th century, Islam has found its way through Central Asia to Xi'an. And there's a very nice garden with a part of the early mosque complex in Xi'an. So Islam has always been on the scene from about the 8th, 9th century onwards. In Xi'an, too, is a very important Christian monument, a stele dated to 781, which is very important in understanding that we have Christians in China by this period. In fact, there's a date on it which says that the Christians arrived in Xi'an in 635, so in the early 7th century. It has a very interesting inscription, and on the right you can see there's a cross on a lotus flower, which is the first example of it. At Danhuang, very important, of course, for the Buddhist cave complex with many famous images in the cave painted here, and for the manuscripts that were found by Western explorers in the early 20th century. But you can, if you visit Danhuang, which is a wonderful example of Buddhist art that has survived from the early period through to the Mongol period, very fine examples that you can see here. Some of the wall paintings as well at Danhuang. And, of course, a very important book, which Joyce will say more about in a moment, is the Diamond Sutra, discovered and taken back to and now in the British Museum, and is considered to be the earliest printed book. It's a block, woodblock print of a book, and a wonderful example of technology and book production in Danhuang and China in the Tang Dynasty. Some modern explorers, Oral Stein and Paul Palio, the French explorer, you can see him on the right picture here in Cave 17, the secret cave where many manuscripts were taken by Western explorers and archaeologists in the early 20th century, now ended up in Berlin and Paris and the British Library in London. One example, a great example of a journey that was made by a Chinese Buddhist pilgrim, Xuanzang, in the period Tang Dynasty. You can see his dates here, and you can see something from the map. If you start to the top right, his journey from Xi'an, Chang'an, right through to Turfan's Chinese Central Asia, down into India proper. He was going on a journey looking for Buddhist sutras. The Chinese in this period in the 7th century didn't feel that they had the true Buddhist tradition, and so Xuanzang and others made this great pilgrimage to India to recover the original sutras of the Buddha. And Xuanzang is also known to you as the Monkey King from a famous novel, Chinese novel of the 16th century, I'm sure. Many of you have seen the films made about Monkey King, but it's based upon the great pilgrimage of Xuanzang in the 7th century. Bandits on the Silk Road. Here's a wall painting from Danhuang showing that this whole business of travelling through the Silk Road was a very dangerous business at occasions, so you could be attacked by bandits and held up, as you can see in this wall painting. Danhuang not only has this fantastic collection of course, very important Buddhist statues and wall paintings, but it has little sort of illustrations of day-to-day life, which are very important. Of course, this pilgrimage still goes on today in the modern form, and you can see on the left this Chinese Buddhist monk with his mobile phone, so he's keeping up to date with all the modern technology. Turfan. I want to take you to Turfan, which is a very important center in Chinese Central Asia, in Xinjiang, just to give you something of a picture of the environment here. It's very remote and very hot, and one of the lowest points on Earth. But it's a very interesting area on the Silk Road, and you can still visit today. It was famous in the ancient world for grapes and for melons. And melons, which were taken from Turfan along with grapes, were taken all the way to Xi'an, to the Chinese emperor's court, and they were packed in special boxes and packed around with ice, which they brought down from the mountains. And so this is a really good example of refrigeration of fresh fruit. And then it went on a long day's journey all the way into China to the Chinese emperor's court from this area. It's famous also for its raisins. You can see here on the left is one of the drying houses for producing these wonderful raisins that you can get from Turfan. Example of the presence of Islam in Turfan, local architecture. You can see the minaret in the local brick-built tradition on the right here. Buddhism, of course. Turfan has many examples from the ancient period of Buddhist caves. I'd like you to note on the left, here's a standing image of the Buddha, but look at all the Westerners that are standing around bringing offerings to the Buddha. You can see Persians and Indians, Sogdians and others in all sorts of different headgear and facial expressions and so on. It's showing about the cosmopolitan nature of Turfan in this Tang Dynasty particularly, and the Westerners who are coming through and passing through here. There is another religion, a Western religion, called Manichaeism that began in the 3rd century, the Common Era, which was very important in this area of Central Asia, again in the Tang Dynasty. Amongst the Uyghur people, they embraced this Western religion of Manichaeism. You can see an illustration from the 10th century fragment that is found at Turfan. I find it very interesting that if you look at the bread that's on the middle of the section on the left, it has a little design on it, and you can see that same design on the bread that's still produced in Xinjiang today. It's a little sort of spiral design. You can see it on this 10th century manuscript on your left. So the traditions are still continuing. Around Turfan, there are many Silk Road cities which are now in a state of disrepair. From about the 13th, 14th century onwards, the Silk Road began to decline. We have some wall paintings from a Christian church in Gaochang here. You can see a few more examples of these ancient cities that you can visit, which in the heyday during the Tang Dynasty, there were Buddhist communities, Manichaean communities, Christian communities, all living side by side, showing you the cosmopolitan atmosphere that existed on the Silk Road in this area of Turfan. Here you can see a Buddhist stupa on the left and some idea of the local landscape in relationship to these cities. There are about three of these different ancient cities that you can visit around Turfan. It is an oasis city. It relies completely for its water and it's growing its fruit because of the water that's brought through on underground channels to the city. This is the same in many cities throughout Central Asia. I'd just like to finish with the Mongol Empire because this is another period during the Mongol period. You can see here from this map how it extends right from the South China Sea towards the Mediterranean. This huge landmass, this huge empire. This opened up things again for international trade and cultural exchange during the 13th and 14th century. Kublai Khan and one of his consorts you can see a beautiful hat that she's wearing here, was, of course, famous leader in China. Marco Polo, of course, is known to us as Westerners. He's one of many Westerners, by the way, who made this journey, not the only one. We have other accounts which are just as important as Marco Polo's account, but here you can see. This was well-established during the Mongol period. Of course, Marco Polo and his family got rich on the back of Westerners going to China at this point because they were used as middlemen in trade between the Mongols and the Chinese. The Mongols tended to use foreigners in this international trade. They weren't dealing necessarily directly with the Chinese in terms of trade. At Hangzhou in China, you can see Marco Polo is celebrated. It was a place where one of the manuscripts mentions that he was a governor in the city for about 2 years. Marco Polo, one of the things that he discovered in China was paper money, which was unknown in the West. And here you can see an example of it on the right from the Mongol period. Chinese paper money on the left is an illustration of this in a Western book of the tales of Marco Polo. And just to tell you something else about research that I do in China, these are still from the Mongol period. We have some tombstones from a family of Italians. Two tombstones have been found. You can see their dates from the Viglione family, showing the presence of foreigners in China in this period of the Mongols on the back of the international trade. In South China, at Changzhou, where I've worked and we have a research project, this was a very important port during the Mongol period. It's where Marco Polo and Ibn Battuta, another famous Muslim traveller, arrived and left China. You can see the boat building on the right, ancient ship there. It's famous, of course, for its Buddhist monuments. Also for its mosques. Again, this is on the South China coast, showing this mixture of religious communities here. We even have a Manichaean shrine. Manichaeism lasted in China through to about the 17th century, so it's quite late, and it was absorbed into the local Buddhist tradition. So here in this local shrine, Mani is considered to be a Buddha. But it's a religion that's come from Syria, Mesopotamia, right back from the 3rd century. And we have a whole collection of Christian tombstones, which we've been investigating and publishing. Here you can see the cross on the lotus flower. You saw that earlier on in the Tang Dynasty. Here it is from the Mongol period. And with a script here, the Fagspar, which was invented during the Mongol period, based on Tibetan. And another example of this long journey, this is the one that Rabban Salma made all the way from Khan Balak or Beijing, Peking. In the you can see the dates of his journey. And he traveled all the way to the west, met the Pope in Rome, met the English king and the French king in Bordeaux. This was part of a diplomatic mission the Mongols were making to the west at this point. It's very interesting to speculate that if this diplomatic mission had paid off and the West had joined the Mongols to drive out the Mamluks and the Muslims from the Middle East, we'd have a totally different history, Western history. But the West wasn't interested in this alliance with the Mongols at this period. But it's a very interesting journey. You can read about this journey. It is available in an English translation. And in Inner Mongolia, some of the Christian monuments that have been discovered in recent years, there are quite a few of these, showing again how widespread Oriental, Eastern Christianity was to Central Asia and to Mongolia in this period, 13th and 14th centuries. So at the end of your journey, you want something to eat and you want a bit of a brush-up. This is the sort of thing that you have to indulge in. So sheep's heads and having a shaving kashgar is what you need, I'm sure, if you don't need a sleep at the end of the day. Now, that's all I've had time to give you a little bit of an overview about some of the things that I'm interested in. If any of you are interested in traveling the Silk Road, there is a possibility of a new tour coming up fairly soon. I've left a sheet on the table by the front door, so if anybody wants to leave their details, please do. But I'll have to finish there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. And it's all just a teaser, isn't it? We sort of more. Our next speaker is Joyce Morgan. Joyce is an arts journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald and co-author of Journeys on the Silk Road, which is the story of the oldest printed book, the world's oldest printed book, the Diamond Sutra written or printed in 868. Joyce has worked as a journalist for more than three decades in London, Sydney and Hong Kong. Her writing has appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, The Guardian and The Bangkok Post, and has written on arts and culture since 1994. She's the senior arts writer at the Sydney Morning Herald, a former arts editor of the paper, and has worked as a producer with ABC Radio, and has travelled extensively in Asia, in India, Pakistan, China and Tibet. And by coincidence, we worked remotely on a little case, I think about a year ago, where we were trying to prevent the sale of some human remains in a Sydney art shop. So quite a diverse series of experiences. So we'd like to welcome Joyce to the thingy here. And
Well, thank you, Mike, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming along. It's great to be here and to talk to you in conjunction with this fantastic exhibition. I'm just going to get the slideshow going. I might need Conrad. This is my partner and co-author, Conrad Walters, going to help me a little bit with the slideshow. To just click this on. Okay. The story that I want to talk to you about today is about the discovery of the Silk Road's greatest hidden treasure. And the story starts in the year 1900 when a monk in a Buddhist meditation cave on the edge of the Gobi Desert noticed a crack in a wall. He broke it open, and behind it lay a hidden chamber. And it was full from floor to ceiling with scrolls. And these scrolls had been hidden in that cave for 1,000 years. Now, among those thousands of documents was the world's oldest printed book. That's a Buddhist text that we just referred to before, that Ken spoke about. And it's a Buddhist text by the name of the Diamond Sutra. Now, the story I was interested in, and the one that I wrote about, was how it got from a cave in the Gobi Desert to become one of the most precious items in the British Library. And that's where it is today. The fact that it isn't there is due to an explorer by the name of Oral Stein. Now, Stein, he set off on a remarkable journey and a very dangerous and secret journey in the year 1906. And to write the book, I retraced his steps across the desert, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a while. But first of all, Stein himself, he was born in Hungary in 1862. He was skilled in languages. He was quite an eccentric man. He was certainly a loner. He never married. He never even had a permanent home. In fact, he lived in a tent for much of his mature years, a tent on a hillside in Kashmir in the north of India. And although he didn't marry and he didn't have a family, he was never entirely alone because he always had a little dog by his side. In fact, he had seven dogs, and they were all but one of them were fox terriers, and he called them all the same name. He called each one Dash. Having a bit of trouble, Conrad. Ah, here we are. That's it. That's his hillside in Kashmir with Dash, or one of the Dashes, sleeping under it. That, in fact, was his very favourite Dash the dog, and the one who accompanied him all the way on this extraordinary journey that took him across the desert from India to Dunhuang. Stein was interested in ancient civilizations, and in particular, he was interested in the way in which Buddhism travelled. And he suspected that under the sands of the Taklamakan Desert, which is in the west of China now, he suspected that under what's now a Muslim region lay lost Buddhist civilizations. The Taklamakan Desert, you can see it, it's like that sort of egg-shaped kind of center of what is now Xinjiang province in China. It's a very fearsome desert, and it has a perhaps an apocryphal translation, Taklamakan. It's said to translators, "Go in and you won't come out." And plenty of people have never come out. It's dangerous because it's prone to incredible dust storms that even in the early years of last century buried an entire caravan of, I think it was 40 men and their animals, and they're all lost under these storms. So they kind of can blow for days, and you can read various accounts of these dreadful storms, and they sound apocalyptic. People have written about the sky turning red and then black and these howling winds. So it's a very, very fearful desert. And there's other tales that Marco Polo have related, lots of local talk stories about this region of being inhabited by goblins and evil spirits and demons. Anyway, this was the desert that in 1906 Oral Stein headed across. It was a journey of extremes because he had to cope with completely different climates. At times in the summer, this was a two-year journey, more than 2 years, and at times it was so hot that he'd have to travel at night, as many ancient people along the Silk Road, of course, did. But in winter, when he was also working in the desert, it was so cold that his moustache would freeze in the night, and he'd have to sleep breathing through the arm of his coat. So when he headed off in this journey, he headed off from the north of India, where he'd been working as a minor official with the British Raj. And he arrived in the great oasis of Kashgar, which Ken just showed you a few pictures of, right at the edge of the Taklamakan Desert. And he was accompanied on that journey, as I said, with Dash the Great, who he had a special coat made for to cope with this cold weather. Kashgar was then, as it still is, you know, it's a major oasis. And in Kashgar, he put together his caravan of animals. He bought there lots of camels. He bought horses. And he also hired a number of men. He hired the gentleman on the right was his translator, who became very important. And without him, he may never have actually got the Diamond Sutra. The man at the top is his mailman, who used to take his letters, and Stein wrote many, many letters. He'd have to carry them across the desert and get them back to an oasis. And the man on the left is his camel man, who had an incredibly bad temper, and he was forever having to be pulled out of scraps. But he was a really good camel man, and he loved his animals. So he thought he was worth the trouble. Anyway, so Stein's goal was ultimately Dun Huang. It took him a good while, about a year, to get there, because he was doing a lot of exploration in the desert. He was digging up at various sites along the way. But the reason he wanted to get to Dun Huang was he wanted to see those caves of the Thousand Buddhas that are just outside Dun Huang. He'd heard about them, and at that stage, 1906, very few Westerners had actually been there at that stage. So he had heard of them from a Hungarian who'd been on one of the first expeditions to ever go there. So he was very keen to see these caves. Dun Huang was once one of the most important oases along the Silk Road. And of course, you know, we know now that the Silk Road was the great trade route that connected China with the Mediterranean. And it wasn't just goods that travelled the Silk Road. Ideas also travelled. And one of the most important ideas that travelled along the Silk Road was Buddhism. Buddhism was born in India, in the Himalayan foothills. But to reach China, it took a very roundabout route. And and that's largely because of the geography, because it had to go around mountains. It couldn't go directly. It had to kind of skirt around them. As it travelled, I mean, that's kind of, in some ways, what we think of as the archetypal Buddhist image. But as it travelled, it took on many of the characteristics of the lands through which it travelled. When it reached the north of what we now think of sort of Pakistan and Afghanistan, Gandhara, it took on very kind of Western features. I mean, that's not your traditional image. That's a what I like to think of as a Buddha with a six-pack. It's very macho, you know, with the moustache and the rippling muscles. So, you know, Buddha's face kept changing. And these were the sort of ideas and stories that Stein was interested in, how these travelled, what were the changes. Anyway, he had, as I said, he was very keen to get to Dun Huang. And one of the reasons Dun Huang was such an important oasis is because it was where this part of the Silk Road separated it to skirt around that desert. So one route went over the top of it, another route went underneath it. So what happened was, you know, that route from Dun Huang to Kashgar, it was a very dangerous section of the Silk Road. It was dangerous because, as I mentioned, of the dust storms, but it was also prone to the bandits, and Ken showed us a picture of some of the bandits, and lack of water. So, you know, it's not surprising that at that area these caves were created, because anyone who was going along that section of the Silk Road would naturally kind of want to pray for a safe journey. Or if they just arrived, having come the other way from the west, you know, they perhaps want to give thanks that they've actually survived. So really, as long as the Silk Road was surviving and thriving, the Dun Huang and the caves did too. The caves themselves, Magao Caves are also known as, they're a network of painted caves. They're full of beautiful frescoes. And that, you know, today they're the world's greatest gallery of Buddhist art. They were painted over about a 1,000-year period. The first one was carved out in about 366. And they stretch over a kilometre in a river valley that's surrounded by the desert. 500 of those caves still remain today. When Stein set his heart on there, he had to cross the desert, which he did in 1907. He actually went from, you know, the what we think of as the Southern Silk Road right across the desert. That's him with his caravan. That's one of the few shots there are of him with his team crossing the desert, the Taklamakan Desert. He did stop, obviously, along the way, and he also had a photo taken with his core people. That's him in the front, and that's little Dash the dog with his specially made for little coat on, and his key men. So they were the main people who accompanied with him on this journey. When he got to the caves, they were pretty much deserted. This is how they looked in 1907. Some of you have perhaps been there and know that they look very different today. For a start, they all have doors on them, so that helps preserve the artwork that's left inside them. Anyway, so when he arrived in Dun Huang, he was very keen to get to the caves. But while he was in the oasis, something made him even more keen to get out there, because he heard a rumour. The rumour he heard was that within the cave complex, quite recently, a hidden cave had been discovered that contained manuscripts. And the rumour was that these manuscripts were still there. So he got out to the caves. He described them as looking like troglodyte dwellings. Anyway, he got out there and he met the guardian of the temple. This is a man by the name of Abbot Wang, who was a Taoist priest, actually, not a Buddhist priest. And he was a sort of self-appointed guardian there. Stein wanted to see inside this hidden cave, and initially Wang didn't want him to get inside at all. You know, Wang was worried that he would lose his patronage because he relied on patrons to support his restoration and his looking after his guardianship of the caves. So he's frightened of what would happen. So there's quite a lot of argy-bargy, but eventually Wang does allow Stein in to the cave, and of course he's absolutely amazed at what he sees with all these thousands upon thousands of scrolls. We're not sure exactly how many scrolls, but it's possibly around 60,000. Of course, Stein wants to get them out and have a read of them, have a look at them, and reluctantly Wang allows a few out and then a few more. Of course, because they've been locked away for 1,000 years in this cave, in this dry desert, they're perfectly preserved. You know, they're absolutely ideal conditions. Stein starts looking at some of the scrolls, but then there's so many that are coming out, he can't really look at them properly. And although he's a scholar and he's very experienced in a number of languages, Chinese isn't one of them, and most of them are in Chinese. So he doesn't really know what he's got. But eventually he and Wang negotiate, and Wang agrees to sell him some of these, controversially, agrees to sell him some of these scrolls. Most of the scrolls were handwritten. In fact, nearly all of them were handwritten. But there was one completed printed text, and that's the Diamond Sutra. But, you know, because he was so busy, you know, going through them and took so many, he really didn't know what he had. So the fact that he got it in one way was simply a lucky accident for Stein. So the Diamond Sutra itself, it's 5 meters long, it's 23 centimeters high, and at one end it has a little colophon, a little inscription, and that tells you its date, which translates to 868, and it tells you that it was made to be given away for free. So 868, you know, it's woodblock printed, but that printing, you know, it's 500 years before Gutenberg got ink on his fingers, and printing in the West, you know, was a great revolutionary invention, and you know, helped usher in things like the Enlightenment. At the other end of the Diamond Sutra is this beautiful illustration, and it's obviously the Buddha is the centre of it. And just down the bottom, I'm not sure how well you can see it, this little figure here is one of the Buddha's great disciples called Subhuti. And the Diamond Sutra itself is a sort of a question and answer session between the Buddha and this disciple, Subhuti. The substance, if you like, the essence of the Diamond Sutra tells us about how reality is ever changing, that what we think is real is what we think is reality isn't really, that it's about fleeting illusions. It talks about a bubble in a stream is the way to look on reality. And I always think it's incredibly ironic that this scroll, which is dealing with impermanence, has been so enduring. It wasn't, as I said, the only scroll in the cave, although it is the only, you know, completed, dated one and printed one. There were many other items. Some of them were works on paper, like this drawing of a camel, which I think looks so contemporary. You know, you could almost see Tanberg having drawn that yesterday. I think that's a beautiful drawing. There was also a lot of secular material. There was a eulogy for a donkey. There was a drunken apology letter. If you behave very badly, it was like the letter you wrote the morning after to apologize for your bad behavior. There was also silks. There was embroideries. That one's now one of the great treasures in the British Museum, and it was one that Abbot Wang was actually using to level the floor in the cave. This one is a painting on silk that is now in Paris, and what is interesting about that is it's one of the first depictions, I think the first, of a firearm in art, and it's that fire lance just up the top there. And just below is someone throwing a hand grenade. So I find that quite a curious kind of image. It's about, you know, the demons attacking the Buddha, but they're really interesting kind of demons. Of course, Stein had to get it all back to all this material across the desert and then back to England. And, it was a very arduous journey. In fact, just getting across the desert, he very nearly died of thirst, as did his team. That was probably the lowest point of their whole time. They just found water in time, and that was what saved their life. They came across some water after, you know, they'd run out, and they were preparing to make what they called a starvation camp. He carried on after that. He had to get it through the mountains back to India, and I won't go into that except to say it was a journey in which he lost most of his toes to frostbite. Of course, if you're doing this journey today, it's a heck of a lot easier than it was in Stein's time. And as I was researching the book, that's the journey that Conrad and I undertook. So we started off in Kashgar in the oasis where Stein had assembled his caravan, and of course it is still a very busy oasis and a market. We travelled actually during Ramadan when the days were, Ramadan came in summer, and the days were incredibly long, so people were without food or water all day. And in the evening, at some signal from the mosque, you would go down to the bazaar, and it would actually be like a feeding frenzy. There was more than... it was like a feeding frenzy. All this kind of food would suddenly just vanish, and more than once we had to change kind of places. We didn't feel like we could eat before people who hadn't eaten all day. But by the time we got to the wok, you know, there was just like an oily heap left in the bottom of this giant kind of thing. So food, you know, of course becomes very... important and very attractive, and that bread that Ken also described is—it's actually the best bread I've ever tasted. If some of you who've been there will know kind of what I mean. It's absolutely delicious. I wish there was somewhere I could get it here. The butcher appealed a little less to me, I must say. it was. You know, the Uyghur child in Kashgar. The city, you know, it's changing dramatically. It's as more and more Han Chinese move in there, and of course it's quite a restive area. And, you know, it really is undergoing change, and there's no greater example of this than this sign we saw in the middle of the bazaar, which is for what every oasis, I think, needs, a golf course. We went on, just briefly, we went on to Khotan, where Stein had worked for quite a while, which, again, is a busy bazaar, huge fabric bazaar. It was once a centre of silk making, and there are still some silk being made there, and I've visited their family business that was still making silk. I was also even more interested to find that not only was silk still being made, but I discovered what was his builder, sort of the last paper maker in the Taklamakan Desert, mulberry paper maker. Why I found that so fascinating was because he is making the paper from the same sort of material that the Diamond Sutra was made of, this mulberry paper, which is extremely strong. Anyway, he took us into his compound. You know, we rocked up without any appointment or anything, just on his doorstep, and he's very happy to show us how he made it. If you cross the desert now, as Stein did, of course, you can catch a bus. You don't have to rely on camels or anything. The landscape is quite extraordinary in parts. That's a whole area. It's almost a desert within in a desert, which look like great sculptural forms. You get to Don Huang today, and this is a little lake just outside it, a sort of crescent-shaped moon lake, which is where Stein actually would have liked to have been buried, he said, but he'd probably be glad he isn't now, because there's an awful lot of sand tobogganing and, you know, tourists there today. Magao itself is about a 30-minute bus ride from Don Huang. And, you know, the caves, this is a very typical kind of design, if you like. There's that central altar covered in murals. And all these caves have been hand-carved into the cliffside. They're not natural caves. They've all actually been, you know, carved out. Some of them are undergoing conservation, and I was lucky enough to spend some time in the caves with the conservators to see what they're doing. There's quite a lot of statues still there, including this huge sleeping Buddha. The library cave itself, from which Stein took all the material, is empty today. Except for a statue of a monk who that cave was initially his memorial. The scrolls, of course, have all gone. Many of them are in London, in the British Library, but some are elsewhere in Russia and Paris. Why the cave was sealed in the first place 1,000 years ago is still a mystery. Nobody really knows why they were sealed in there. Some say it was just a storeroom. Some say it was a threat of invasion. But nobody really knows that. But what we do know is that, you know, it's because of the material that was found in that cave, from which we're still learning. And it's because of that we know so much now about the Silk Road today. And, you know, I guess, what it says to me is that this dry desert, you know, dead men don't tell tales, but dead deserts do. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Joyce, for, again, another visually stunning quick tour of the area. I'm again conscious of time. Now, I believe you're having a book signing after this down in the hall. Good. So there's an opportunity, guys. Do check out the... if you haven't seen the exhibition already, have a look. But also the shop attached to the exhibition is also great fun. Even just to look, even just to browse. Now, conscious of time, I think we'll go straight to any questions from the audience. So if anyone has any questions, please. But can you wait until we get a microphone to you? I'll invite Ken up to the chairs as well.
I was just curious as to why all the scrolls have gone to England and all the other places. Are any retained in China?
Most of them went to England and Paris because at the turn of the century, Amistan was the first one at the caves, and it's because of him thousands of them ended up in London. He was then followed by subsequent explorers such as Paul Pellio that Ken referred to, who also took a lot of those scrolls. Some of them are still in China, but most of them have been spread around the world. There's quite a lot in Russia as well, in St. Petersburg. So they have been spread. At the time, and of course that's controversial today, because today, you know, to run off, you know, to do what Stein did, you know, is not how an explorer and an archaeologist would behave today. However, that, you know, 100 years ago, it was a somewhat different conditions. At the time Stein took them, you know, it was that height of that great, you know, the Great Game era and an imperial era. So that's why they ended up being, you know, dispersed around the world. I've got to say, you know, at the moment, in the last probably decade, these scrolls are, in a sense, being reunited in cyberspace. You can now actually see them on the websites that I can mention that have very good resolution. So a lot of them are obviously too fragile. You wouldn't be able to see them, you know, really wherever you were. But because of a lot of the technology now, you can see them, including the Diamond Sutra, in an incredible detail. But that's the reason that they ended up dispersed.
Perhaps we should say that the International Dun Huang Project, based at the British Library in London, is an international project, and there are many Chinese scholars involved with the work on these scrolls. So it has become an international project, not just a British or Western project now.
I was wondering what Stein did after he delivered these scrolls to the British Museum in his later career. Was he a scholar, or did he keep adventuring looking for archaeologists?
He had he kept exploring. Basically, he did go back to Dun Huang, and he went back to Turkestan a couple of times. He kept exploring right until the last moment, until his 80s. When his great dream was to go to Afghanistan, and for various reasons he was denied that through his life. And finally, when he was in his early 80s, he got permission to go, and he was headed off, he got to Kabul, and in fact he reached Kabul and he took ill, had a stroke and didn't recover, and he's actually buried in the Christian cemetery in Kabul. His grave site's there today, and one of my colleagues at the Sydney Morning Herald recently, I asked if he'd go and visit and take some photos, and did, and his grave is still being tended there by a Muslim man, and has been by him and his father before him for many, many years.
That one. We need some competition from this side.
Don't be shy.
Quite a different area. You mentioned, that there was a period of decline for the Silk Road, and I'm wondering if you could just give us some sense of why, what were the main factors involved in the decline of the use of the Silk Road for whatever it had been used for previously. Thanks.
Yeah, a lot of it was to do with the change in politics. After the Mongol period had ended towards the end of the 14th century, the states of Central Asia started splitting up. So there wasn't an overall political control of this area. And once it started splitting up into smaller states and in both the east and the west of the Pamir Mountains into Uzbekistan on one side and Xinjiang on the other, then you have a whole different political, geopolitical situation. And so really after the 14th century, it started to decline and never really attained its heyday that it had during the Tang Dynasty. And at the same time, the maritime route was opening up, and of course the development in technology under, at least from the 15th century with Chinese technology, meant that there was much more to do with the maritime route, which was an easier route for this sort of shipment and international trade that was going on. That's why when you go to Tarfan and you go to these places in Central Asia, you find or were discovered by Orlstein and others in the early, late 19th and early 20th century, why they're in such disrepair, because they were, these cities were just abandoned. But it meant that when Western explorers went in the late 19th and early 20th century, they were able to rediscover many of these fantastic cities on the Silk Road, and not just discover the cities, but scrolls, wall paintings, all sorts of artifacts and objects which we can see today.
Who funded Stein's adventures?
Yeah, his adventures and his travels were funded by the British Museum and by the government of India. I mean, he was funded, at a time when, and it sounds, quite appalling to us today, but when museums were, thought it was okay to go off and go dig up in the other people's countries and dig it up and bring it home. And there was a great, it was a time of great rivalry between, the imperial powers to kind of get these objects to fill their museums. So the British Museum and the government of India were the two backers of his travels. Certainly the first two travels that he did into Turkestan.
One more? Oh, yes, look. Very great way to finish. We get a bit of balance in the audience.
This question is for either speaker. At the exhibition, there was a letter that I saw written by a woman, and I'm not sure what the letter was referring to, but there was a lot of distress and that sort of thing. Do you know the letter that was exhibited? I'm just sort of wondering whether along the research that you've done, whether you've discovered anything about women's experiences on this Silk Road journey or journeys on the Silk Road. That's all.
I do know that letter. I just saw it. I wasn't familiar with that one before. The only other letter that sticks in my mind, written by a woman, is a Sogdian woman, I think. She was married to a merchant, and she... her husband had basically dumped her in Don Huang, and hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, not even, 1,000-odd years ago. It was a letter Orlstein found that had been dropped. He found it somewhere near the Jade Gate. And the fury from this letter, she talks about, how angry she is. She's been dumped in Don Huang. She's got no money. And she ends up by saying, "I'd rather be a pig's wife than yours."
I think it's worth pointing out, too, that at both at Dun Huang and in Turfan, women are represented in the wall paintings a lot. And it shows that the patronage to the Buddhist communities not just came from men, but it came from women, particularly those who are in a position to give money to the for the painting of these wall paintings and these sculptures. So I think women seem to have been quite prominent in the history of the Silk Road. And there may be that there's much more to discover, because many of these manuscripts that are still in the British Library are still not being fully edited. So we still don't know what's yet to be found out, and maybe more things will be discovered.
I think that's a lovely human and humorous note upon which to finish this session. I'd like you, would you all thank Joyce and
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.